Posloucháte podcast na fintech.cz.
When and how sharply will the central banks, the Fed and ECB, start reducing the base interest rates?
So our expectation last year had been that the Federal Reserve would cut rates six times in 2024. And we had that expectation quite early in 2023, so it was not market consensus at the time. As time has gone on, obviously the Fed pivoted in December, or indicated that rates were likely at their peak. Okay. Since then, markets went on a very aggressive repricing of rate expectations. So the markets at one point were forecasting, you know, six rate cuts beginning in March, so quite early. We don't believe that it will be that quick or that aggressive. And indeed, since December, we have had an inflation print in the US higher than expected, marginally higher, but higher nonetheless. And we think that the reaction function of central banks will be extremely sensitive and careful to not making a policy mistake. And what I mean by that is, once they start cutting, they need to be 100% sure that their long-term inflation target and that inflation expectations are sufficiently anchored that they can continue with a loosening cycle. So they don't want a stop-start, and they really want to avoid this. And this is very clear to us from some Fed governors' speeches, from Q&A. So on the European side, again, the ECB has been very forthright in trying to manage market expectations. Clearly, policy is restrictive. Our growth outlook for Europe is pretty weak for this year. So it's a delicate balancing act. And we think the ECB will be less aggressive than the Fed. We think the Fed will go first. So we could see, you know, 100, 125 basis point rate cuts in the US and maybe 100 in Europe. But I mean, frankly, whether it's in March or April or May is a bit academic from our perspective. You know, we can say for sure our expectation is that policy is at its tightest and will loosen from here. The discussion about when precisely that happens is it's not unimportant, but strategically we think that it gives us the framework to think about how we manage clients' assets.
What do you think about the condition of economy in USA? And we can speak about the condition of economy in EU too.
The US was very, very resilient last year. So again, if I go back to what our expectations had been this time last year, okay, we expected that the tightening of policy in the real economy, so a very large increase and rapid increase in interest rates to fight inflation, that would have had quite a negative impact on the real economy. We would have expected that tightening financial conditions would have impacted corporates, would have impacted corporate earnings. And that didn't happen in 2023. Corporate earnings were very resilient. The consumer was very resilient. And we think what happened really, you had a banking crisis in March 2023, Silicon Valley Bank, or you had a nascent banking crisis that the authorities were very prompt and very quick to flush out. So you had a lot of liquidity, in fact, put into the financial markets. This supported financial assets. The US economy is an asset-based economy. If financial assets are performing, the US economy performs, the consumer performs. There's quite a strong correlation between the performance of financial assets and how the rest of the economy does, spending patterns, consumption patterns, etc. Now, at the same time, we did have a very radical increase in mortgage rates to 8%. Very, very rapid doubling of mortgage rates, in fact, at the early part of the year. So we do think that at the beginning of this year, looking forward, all of the policy tightening that has been put into the system is working its way through the system. So now we can see signs of slowdowns, particularly in the labor market. And this is going to be key into the Fed's decision making, because the Federal Reserve has a dual mandate. It's targeting a 2% inflation rate, but it also has a mandate for a stable unemployment rate, a low unemployment rate. And unemployment has been effectively at full employment, you could say, in the US. Employment dynamics are changing in the US. Hiring has stopped. New hiring has stopped, okay? This will come in the figures. And these things can change pretty rapidly. The economy, we think, is probably quite a bit weaker underlying than GDP reported numbers the last couple of quarters. So we do expect a substantial slowdown, and that will inform the policy setting. In Europe, it's a bit more of a fragmented situation, as usual. Pan-European growth rates we expect to be quite anemic, but there's quite a range. You know, Germany is in recession already. And Europe, you know, is very susceptible to some things that the US is not. You know, the US is energy independent, effectively. The US is a net exporter of energy. Europe is very much at the mercy of energy prices, and any kind of risk to energy price dynamics impacts Europe and impacts European confidence. Something we're missing in Europe, obviously, is a policy framework on the fiscal side, where we can equalize and spread payments, etc., and economic impetus in different countries. So a country like Spain is performing a lot better than Germany. A country like France is performing. Spain and France are at one end of the spectrum. You know, Italy and Germany at the other end of the spectrum. So it's quite a fragmented picture. The NGEU, so the New Generation Growth Fund, and the way that that is going to be dispersed, and I'm talking here about fiscal impulses, that's not a one-size-fits-all. We don't have a fiscal pact across Europe. We only have a monetary policy. So Europe has kind of one hand tied behind its back in some respects, in terms of the policy levers that we can apply versus the US.
When I spoke with your colleague from Boston last year, he supposed that the US economy will go to the recession, and we can see good results in USA.
Yep.
Do you think that the US economy will go to the recession or not?
It could. I mean, we think it could enter a kind of a technical recession. It mightn't feel like a recession. It might feel like a slowdown. But I guess, to my previous point, you know, these things can happen quite quickly or suddenly. If you get a monthly change in the unemployment rate, that can have an impact on the psychology, if you like. Recently you had quite a fall in the participation rate in the US labor market. If that fall in the participation rate had not happened, you would have seen a meaningful increase in the unemployment rate by about 0.3% month on month. That would have been something for the Federal Reserve to think about. So we do think there's underlying weakness there. But it surprised us on the upside. The resilience of the economy did surprise us. Officially, our call is still for a recession, but that could be a very shallow recession, a technical recession where quarter-on-quarter growth might dip slightly negative. But at the end of the day, we know that we're facing into a policy loosening environment. So the extent to which the market will look through that, and asset markets already did, if we look at the fourth quarter last year, and certainly the last few weeks of last year when the Fed did pivot, risk assets rallied substantially. So there's a balance, there's a trade-off, but the real economy is slowing for sure. But then there's a financial economy, and that plays to a different tune sometimes.
We have big experience with inflation. People in USA, people in European Union. Do you think that inflation is still a risk for economies in this year?
It is, and the risk. Let's back up for a second and consider that. Policymakers were saying that inflation would not be a problem, okay? And that did not turn out to be the case. So inflation ran up a lot. You could say, looking backwards, which is always easy to do, that policymakers were slow to respond. They did not recognize the inflationary impulses. Now, of course, we had a very exceptional event. We had a global pandemic. We had a lot of policy response to that, so you could say it's an exceptional situation from which we're still unraveling. But inflation dynamics, if you consider the fact that inflation has reduced already from levels of 8, 9, 10%, wherever, considering where you are, down to maybe 4%, the journey from 4 to 2 will likely be much tougher. And the question we ask ourselves is, where will the inflation rate end up? So, you know, central banks globally have this kind of uniform target of 2%, which they define as price stability. Okay, we're still some way from that. And you know, we do think that if the Federal Reserve thinks this long-term neutral interest rate is 2.5%, you know, we're 3% higher than that. So conditions are still very restrictive. They're very restrictive for a reason. Central banks are not confident that they have yet set the economy on a footing that will get it down to 2%. And you know, what needs to happen to get to a lower inflation rate? You know, you do need to engineer a slowdown, which is what's happening, but it's a difficult balancing act. Then when do the authorities begin to take the pressure off and begin to loosen financial conditions, begin to loosen monetary policy? Monetary policy is a very blunt tool, so it's an inexact science for sure. But inflation is a problem for everybody and every actor in the economy, which is why it's such a pernicious problem when it occurs. So central banks have been extremely clear about their determination to get inflation back to a stable footing. And we believe in their determination. And their determination could mean from here that interest rates may stay higher for longer, for example. So that's certainly an outcome that could happen. And we have had inflation prints not only in the US, but also in Europe and in the UK. Inflation prints have printed just a little bit higher than were expected, a little bit higher than the previous print, and I'm talking month-on-month data here. So we've had this happen. So that will give pause for thought. And, like I say, it's this balancing act between the inflation dynamic and then the growth dynamic.
You mentioned the condition of German economy. Why do you think that the German economy is not divorced, but that the German economy has so big problem, not like French, not like in Spain, by just Germans?
Germany is an extremely conservative country in terms of its policy settings. If you think about the German representation in the European Central Bank, historically, it was always the most hawkish member. It was always the most anti-inflationary member. So somehow in the historical conscience, there's this very strong impetus to fight that and to have a strict policy regimes. Allied to that, of course, is the Ukraine war, which delivered a massive shock to the German economy. Politically, obviously, it is, like other European countries, becoming less stable in terms of the economic policy setting. Different actors, different coalitions, etc. So the ground is shifting a little bit underneath. It's obviously a strong economy. It has adopted migrants. You know, it has absorbed a lot of issues coming from other countries, and socially done the right thing, I would say. And I guess that bears a cost on the economy in general. But economics-wise, the policy setting, we think will loosen in Europe, and these positive trends can reassert themselves. The war risk and the geopolitical risk and the energy risk is still there in the background, I guess, and that's that plays a part in the corporate setting in terms of planning. And then if you dive a bit deeper into the sectoral composition of Germany, the car industry is very important. The transition to electric. This is a big trend. You have a lot of EV coming on stream from China. Price pressures are enormous. So there are some industry dynamics at work as well, which are particular to Germany.
If we speak about the German economy, and you mentioned it, the situation in China, what do you think about the development in China?
Yep.
We saw the solid growth. What do you think?
So, China has a growth model. China is a command economy. Okay, so China has full control of the levers of policy. Its stated growth rate of around 5%, it has achieved most recently, 5.2, I think. Our expectation is that China is in a structural transition to a lower growth rate. And what we mean by that is a growth rate that will settle somewhere around 3-3.5%. That's a significant downshift from where we are. China is a much more inward-looking country. If you listen to Chinese policymakers, they talk about the phrase, and it's a very particular political phrase, is they talk about economic nationalism. Okay? And economic nationalism, yeah, this is state-directed capitalism. They have policies like common prosperity. If you listen to Xi speak, he talks about common prosperity. That's all about income redistribution. You know, China, as we know, and we've watched a massive transition in growth. It had the highest, creating the highest number of billionaires globally. You know, so there's a redistribution happening. There is also a substantial problem domestically, which is the property market. And the property market and the extent to which that impacts on personal consumption, personal balance sheets, debt levels, this is a real issue. And we think that that is really the thing that's going to result in this structural growth slowdown. Also, we're in an era of deglobalization, I would say. China will suffer from that in relative terms when we compare it to its previous growth composition. So there are some headwinds, for sure. It's well recognized and known that demographically China in the long term has some problems. China's population has fallen now for the second year in a row. So these are important long-term phenomena, I think, that will somewhat suppress the high growth rate that we've seen. So that's our expectation.
Short question. Do you think that China could help German's economy or European economy like export markets?
Of course, yeah. I mean, there's a very strong link between Europe and Germany. And really, if I look at the performance of European equities or European asset classes, it's highly, highly influenced by China and what happens in China. If you think about the current issue with the Red Sea, for example, 60% of the trade between Europe and China goes through the Suez Canal. Yes. These are really meaningful, and I think it's 14% of global trade. So it's an extremely important link. Obviously, China is part of Asia. It's an important part of Asia. Our view on Asia is that it is in good shape. There are other very large countries in Asia that, politically are quite stable in terms of their inflation dynamics, are quite stable in terms of their policy settings, their very conservative policies being sensibly managed. Yet these countries will benefit from the relative growth dynamics in the region. So if China slows down, other countries, Indonesia, Korea, they will pick up the slack. China also, in terms of its inflation dynamic, you have very low inflation, 0.5-0.4%, and we think that can remain. Now that's a below consensus view, but we think China is really it's in a slow place, and it's going to stay there for the coming years. In fact,
we are speaking about economy, but maybe we should speak more about the politics, and I mean the situation in Ukraine, in Russia, in China, in the European Union. So do you wait in this year something good or bad in this level?
Unfortunately, it's extremely difficult to predict. What we can say with certainty is that geopolitical risk seems to be quite elevated compared to in the past. It's extremely difficult to put a price on that, or to manage the risk of that in a portfolio, for example, or to hedge that risk, okay? So down the years, we have, as part of our investment process, we always think about hedging, we always think about what if we're wrong, and we try to implement some risk-efficient positions in portfolios that could do well in the event of a kind of a non-consensus view. So for the US election in 2016, for example, when you try to hedge yourself against the political risk of somebody like Donald Trump becoming president, it turns out that the market responded extremely positively to that, okay, because he came in and cut taxes and basically supported the domestic economy in a big way. So financial markets really rallied strongly. So irrespective of what you think of the man or his politics, this was the reaction of financial markets. We're now in a situation where, appeasement, we can say that appeasement doesn't seem to work in terms of geopolitics, because you have Russia impose itself on Ukraine. You have a risk that China becomes more assertive vis-a-vis Taiwan, and you have a few flashpoints. And the risk is that 2024 sees a move again in the wrong direction. If you think about the number of elections that we're going to have in 2024, so it's a record actually. So half of the world's population, half of the world's voting population is going to vote in 2024. And you know, when you look around and you can see a lurch in a particular direction politically in many different countries towards more more right-wing, more directive policies. And there's a discussion, our geopolitical analyst would say that if our view on China slowing down is comes to fruition, in history there are many examples of a country in declining growth phase will enter into some sort of a war or go towards an agitation politically in order to, you know, realign domestically the population behind, you know, a strong move. So in the context of the Taiwan election, which we've just had, and we have had the election of a government that is not friendly to the Chinese view of Taiwan, yeah, that's a risk that's heightened, we think. And yeah, it could be an escalation of some sort, saber-rattling, more military exercises, which we have seen, but it just raises the temperature, okay? So that's the geopolitical risk that's going in the wrong direction. We think that Russia would be happy to sue for peace, but that means that they would want to maintain what they have. You have a US election coming in November where the support for that is far from sure. For sure, we can expect more pressure on NATO. We can expect more pressure on European countries to increase their military spending and their budgetary contributions. And that takes money away from other programs. So, and actually, indeed, in China itself, you do have, as part of this economic nationalism, you also have an increase in military spending, okay? So, and then, sorry, we haven't mentioned the Middle East, of course, which it's not our base case that this escalates into a regional conflict, and hopefully it will not, but for sure, we're in a very different situation there than we had been before October the 7th. So everywhere you look, there are fires happening, and historically, wars cause inflation. Wars are inflationary because they're very expensive to finance. So when we look at, you know, if we fold the geopolitical view or what's happening, it's not a view, just the actuality, if you fold that into an economic scenario, then that's an inflationary impetus into a world where we have policymakers thinking they've resolved the inflation problem. These things can become intertwined in a not great way. You know.
Could you tell me how conflict in Ukraine change world trade? I mean, for example, connection Russia, China, and others.
So I guess geopolitically, you now have a situation where, on the one side, you have Russia and China reasserting a stronger relationship. So it's not so much an east-west dichotomy as maybe a north-south dichotomy in the global south. You have India, which is an enormous country growing at 6%. We perceive that that will continue to grow and develop. India is trying to be in between, but geopolitically it's going to become a more important actor. It's easy to see that the US and Europe are less significant or less influential than they have been historically, depending on the outcome of the US election. Well, actually, one issue that both Democrats and Republicans agree on is China. So they're both very hawkish vis-a-vis China. But in terms of their international policy setting, the US can certainly lurch more isolationist, more domestically oriented. So again, if you're Mr. Putin, you're looking on at that as a good opportunity for you to continue to reassert your vision of the world and your behaviors, frankly. And China is in a similar boat. So these kind of global alliances are shifting a bit. They shift as a function of the individuals leading these countries, but they also shift in terms of the longer term policy settings and economics. But yeah, at the end of the day, every country wants to grow. Every country needs to grow in order to keep its population happy, in order to provide a vision of progress for its population, etc. So at the end of the day, countries that seem to be on different sides of the fence, they cooperate. Of course, they cooperate economically. So there are grounds for alliances, there are grounds for agreement. And it's very easy to go to a negative, it's not all black or white. There's lots of gray. But geostrategically, if you like, this axis between Russia and China does give space for other similar leaders globally to assert their worldviews. So in places as disparate as Hungary and Argentina, you can spot an AfD in Germany. Every country, not every country, but many countries have a flavor of this asserting itself. So it's the picture is, it never becomes less complex.
If you look to the markets, which sectors have a good future in this situation?
If we think about sectors and different performance, the US is a good place to start because we have seen a very strong run-up in US asset prices and equity markets. However, if you go one step below, you see that this is substantially driven by a very small number of technology stocks. Okay, AI and the impact of AI on all of us. We're in the very early stages of that story, I guess. But the market has given a very high rating to some market participants. So there's a technology economy, I would say, and there's a technology world that is different, separate and distinct from what we would consider to be the real economy and consumer durables, consumer staples, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, etc. So we somehow have to treat the technology sector on its own, I think, because it's been the key driver. And if you strip that out, frankly, US equities have performed very similarly to many other entities. In a declining rate environment, you would expect things like utilities, more dividend paying strategies to perform quite well, more stable healthcare, consumer staples, etc. And we think we're quite conservatively positioned going into this year. We think that there will be more opportunity for more higher beta exposures later in the year as the policy framework becomes a bit more certain. Small cap equities is something where there's a massive valuation discrepancy between a large cap. And again, it's exacerbated by these mega caps, these huge technology stocks. But as the real economy recovers, and if we get through this slowdown, policy loosens, small caps can be a very interesting place to be in terms of a risk allocation. It's not a one-size-fits-all. For sure, the growth dynamics that we see in the developed markets in the US, in Europe, in the UK, we do not see the same growth dynamics in the emerging world. The emerging world is growing more healthily, notwithstanding the slowdown in China that we expect. A country like India, is printing 6% plus growth. We don't see any reason why that won't continue. Brazil, the emerging world had its inflationary moment before the developed market did, so they're at a different stage in the cycle. Their central banks are loosening policy already. So there is also space fiscally in the emerging world that we don't have in the developed world. So in terms of our risk allocation and our asset allocation, we are more positive on emerging assets in both the equity space, debt, both local currency and hard currency, and also from foreign exchange perspective. And again, that's informed a bit by the growth divergence that we see between emerging and developed markets. We think there's a growth premium that will accrue to emerging markets for the next few years. In the declining US rate environment that we see, we think the dollar can be a kind of a benign influence there. So we don't expect the dollar to be strong on a relative basis, and that can always be a good background for emerging allocations also.
You did not mention army industry, so I'm right. Don't use this mm-hmm. shares.
So in terms of our governance and socially responsible investing, okay, that can be a problematic sector. However, if we have a client who does not wish to adopt that stance, we will, of course. There can be value in different sectors as capital leaves, it gets replaced by other capital. We saw that a lot in the energy space, oil and gas dynamics. One investor pulls out, valuations decline substantially. Somebody else steps up to invest in that, and they get the benefit of the value, or that client does. So, strategically, we think that obviously one of the enormous economic factors that's going to drive all of our behaviors, all of our pricing, all of our capital markets is this transition to a less carbon producing world. And if you pull back from that topic and think about it from a strategic perspective and take the long view and what's going to need to happen in order to have an effective transition, you're going to see an enormous movement of capital, government capital, private capital, personal capital, so our own savings in our own pensions. And if we think about how that capital is going to be managed responsibly into towards a zero transition world, that's going to have some meaningful impacts on a sectoral basis. Defense, the arms industry, it would be nice to think that you could live in a world where governments didn't have a defense budget and they didn't spend all that money on stuff that would do harm to other people. And maybe that's, we could be optimistic perhaps and think that the younger people in their 20s who will be managing our world 30 years from now are different people. They come from a different world. They will bring their different worldviews, one of which will be climate for sure. And if you think, if that's where the focus is going to be, we can hopefully expect that other more regional or more domestic impulses will be lessened somehow, and that countries will realize that they have to cooperate and they have to be on the same page, and they cannot behave radically differently, because that reduces the objective, the success rate substantially. So that's my hope.
I try to change the topic. You are not first time in Czech Republic.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, what do you think about our hot discussion now in Czech Republic about Europe? Because we still have the crowns, some sides, goes to Europe. What do you think? It will be good for us to have Europe or not?
So, as an Irishman, okay, I'm from Ireland, and if I think back to when I was growing up, we had the Irish punt, it was called, the pound, okay, in our language, punt. And our biggest trading partner was the UK. A flight from Dublin to London used to cost about £400, which in today's money is about €600. Now, we can't say that the euro has caused prices to come down, but what we can say is that there's a strong advantage to being part of a single currency bloc. Despite the fact that Europe obviously isn't perfect, it doesn't have the policy making levers on the fiscal side, only on the monetary side, so interest rates are set for everybody, as if it's a one size fits all, even though we know it's not. But you know, there are frictional economic costs associated with having a different currency. And the removal of that friction removes those frictional economic costs. So there are some advantages, I would say. You would be part of I know central banks have all adopted similar inflation targets, but at least in terms of the policy setting, it could be more uniform. So I think that there are always more advantages to being in a club rather than being the one outside a club. And you know, we have a live example of that now. If we look at the UK post-Brexit and look at the real impact on the UK economy that's unfolding, okay? Now the UK, you could argue in the early 90s, it had an opportunity to move closer to the euro with the ERM and you know the kind of band that they had. That didn't happen. Arguably, we can imagine they would have been better off if they had a single currency and be much more unified as part of an important global trading bloc, which is what the EU is. It's what the big advantage of the EU is. But you know, if I look around the Czech economy, I think the Czech economy has been a big beneficiary of a halo effect, if you like, from being European, closely associated with Europe. So the currency is just another small step. I mean, the Danish krona still exists and has a very narrow fluctuation band. But again, you know, these are very domestic, they're very politically sensitive domestic topics, I guess, and people have views and, currencies can have a strong kind of national identity type of flavor to them. But economically, I think the argument is pretty clear that anywhere you remove frictional costs and you're part of something bigger, it can bring a lot of benefits in terms of unanimity, in terms of our ability to travel. You know, if you think of the removal of border frictions, I guess it's probably analogous to that. We have freedom of travel now within Europe. When we didn't have freedom of travel, that was a much more complicated world. So I guess anywhere you ease restrictions, it's going to be a good thing in terms of human mobility, but also capital mobility and economic mobility.
Thank you very much for this answer. And I ask you on one question about sometimes I think, we can hear a discussion about UK, about the Brexit, and about the benefits from EU for UK. And the discussion is very often only about the economics topic. But I didn't hear the discussion about politics topic, about the politic view on Brexit. So what do you think? We can see UK lost after Brexit in economy, but what do you think? Lost UK in the same way in politic level?
I think it has lost a huge amount of influence on the global stage. Unfortunately, it would appear that the whole European question was put on the table in order to resolve a domestic party political debate. Okay, and I'm talking about the Conservative Party, the ruling Conservative Party. So David Cameron offered a referendum as part of an election campaign, and if I think back to Mrs. Thatcher, okay, who came to power in 1979, okay, and then you had the period in the 80s where Mrs. Thatcher was fighting with the what she characterized as the Federalist Europe, Jacques Delors. But Margaret Thatcher was the architect of the single European market, okay? So she knew economically this was a smart and sensible thing to do. But even back then, and this debate within that political party goes right back to that debate. And it has just become more and more polarized and more extreme, if you like. And you now have a situation where the ruling party is tearing itself apart, has torn itself apart on this issue. And to this day continues. So domestically, there will be an election in the UK. The expectation is that the Labour, there will be a change of government. The current government has been in place for 13 years. Okay, so not many governments can survive that long. So maybe it's just a natural change in any case. But the political ructions, if you think about somebody like Boris Johnson, okay, as a political leader on the global stage, representing Britain and Britain's interests, I would have to say that geopolitically, Britain lost a lot of its power, a lot of its influence. And it lost a huge amount of its influence because of its removal from what is de facto the third largest trading bloc in the world. And to exist alone, the idea that the UK or any other country can go and create bilateral trade agreements with, Brazil or Argentina or Australia or Japan, and that this is somehow going to improve the situation. So politically, I think it's been pretty catastrophic, but it's very closely aligned to the economic outcomes, because in order to have political influence, that's an important currency to have, and it has lost economic influence for sure, but it has lost political influence in spades, of course, because it's a small economy on its own, and a service economy, for sure, it has some advantages, and it's a great place, and with the great people, but I guess it's a phase that hopefully can change in time, and there's an internal debate now in terms of polling domestically. More than half the population of the UK, when they're asked, they admit, they recognise that Brexit was a mistake. The question now is, when will the topic come back on the table? And that probably requires a generational change in the politicians that are there. So again, I'll go back to my 20-year-old or my 25-year-old. They're the ones that have suffered big time, that age cohort. So there are now restrictions in place, freedom of travel, freedom to people need visas now. That's a big impediment, I would say. So you can only hope and imagine that people would, sensibly reverse that. And there really is an age cohort, an age angle to this discussion, because the average age of the Conservative voter is quite elderly. And frankly, in another 10 or 20 years, the composition of the voting population is going to change in the UK, and that will give you different outcomes. Sledujte fintech.cz.